Time for the Bill McIntosh Show and a dose of Teddy Roosevelt. You're listening to the Bill McIntosh Show. It's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit, well, it belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives and strives valiantly, who errs, who comes up again short again and again because there's no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls, neither know victory nor defeat. Of the interview, but I don't want to forget. I get so worked up and so engrossed and I forget everything. The world could fall around me and I won't notice. What happened was I became a widower with five kids and I remarried a Peruvian of all crazy things. Yeah. So I had my hands full. My son had cancer, two kids in diapers, and then my wife died. That was amazing. So, and then my father had passed away about 6 years prior, and he was from Louisiana. He was from the Big Easy.
Yeah.
And we still have relatives there, distant relatives, I think. I imagine down there, and it's a great state, and it's just it's an amazing place. It's pretty poor, but it's an amazing place. So much fascinating history and.
It is.
In the Pelican State, my dad loved the state so much that when he, after he left, he was just a little kid when he left. He was, they moved to Alabama and then to Georgia and then to New York, of all places. And when we got a boat on the Hudson River in New York, he named it the Pelican. And we had a sailboat he called the Pelicant. my dad loved the Louisiana and, that whole thing, man, it's just a great. And when people tell you in Peru that we don't have real authentic American food, I said, wait a second. Have you heard of Louisiana, perchance?
That's right. That's the thing, too, is that this area is really a melting pot. And because there has been a lot of suffering because of hurricane, a lot of things. The sure. people in this area, I believe, are very unusual, very resilient. So can understand how your dad liked it.
Yeah. No, and then my grandmother, she was such a darling human being. Oh, my. Such a great. She went through so much suffering. What happened was they were abandoned by their father, and then the mother died. And they were basically orphans. And so they had an uncle, my great-grandmother's brother, Adam Luza was his name. He was a letter carrier and he took him in and it's just a beautiful story how they were just saved by an uncle that cared about his little nieces and they're sweet little kids so that the rest is history. So then my grandfather came down from Minnesota, was a bootlegger and met my grandmother after World War I. He was recruited to be a chief petty officer in the Navy. He had experience with maritime matters and since he was a bootlegger. Can't make this stuff up, man. But then they met in the Big Easy and they got married. And then, my dad remembered when it snowed in New Orleans once, and Little Red Bananas. And that's all the fun adventures they had in that incredible place, So
it is.
Anyway, silly me. Yeah, right. So
It's a lot of history in this area also.
Oh man.
Amazing. I'm originally from Pennsylvania, from south of Pittsburgh, and there's a town called Monongahela, and that was a
revolutionary
area. And then, I come down here and there's just so much history for our nation in this area.
Oh yeah, man.
So
and there's so much in the way of cultural attacks on our American melting pot, our identity. It really angers me. We got to get off this you know, BIPOC, black, indigenous, people of color nonsense. This is ridiculous, you know. I mean, I look, my kids, you know, they're all Hispanic. But if they apply to college as Hispanics, they get, probably you could get a full scholarship. But if they apply as Caucasians, they get the waiting list. A form letter back. What's the deal with that, you know? Anyway, so not to be too negative, but I think you understand where I'm coming from. Oh, okay. Let me just jump into the fray. Cynthia, I put you on Cindy, but yeah, Bill McIndoe Show. Now on with Cynthia Collins. She's the founder of SpeakHope.net. She speaks publicly of her personal story of abortion harm and its aftermath, human trafficking, and the need for our nation to return to a culture of life. Through over 35 years of outreach, Cindy has provided help and care to over 30,000 women and youth. She's served on the Louisiana governor's human trafficking advisory and is also an advisor to Operation Outcry, which is a ministry of the Justice Foundation. And Operation Outcry, folks, check it out. There's a petition called The Moral Outcry. There, go to operationoutcry.org. So back to Cindy. She's been an advocate for women and children throughout the U.S. at the United Nations and the Nation of Israel, Poland, Portugal, Poland, India, and Australia. It's great to have you on the program, Cindy. How are you today in the great Pelican State?
I'm doing great, Bill. It's just great to be here today.
Well, that's good. It's good to have you on. And I wanted to get your reaction. I mean, it's a couple of weeks ago, of course, we had the huge news of Roe v. Wade being overturned. Tell us your reaction to that.
I was very excited. Worked for the overturn of Roe v. Wade, the injustice of Roe v. Wade, of what's happened to women and to the children of our nation for many, many years. So actually, I was in the parking lot of our pregnancy center where I work here also.
Oh, wow.
And
awesome.
I really began weeping, and I gave a shout of thanking the Lord. Thank you, Jesus, for, you know, 50 years. And, you know, I'll tell you a little bit. I feel like I'm very young, but my journey with abortion started when I, to put things in perspective, my journey with abortion started when I was 19 of visiting a Planned Parenthood facility for a pregnancy test, subsequent abortion. And we can talk about a little bit more about that. How it affected me, but now I'm 68. So it's almost 50 years.
Wow.
That of not only my life, but we have to put things in perspective of how this has Roe v. Wade and legalized abortion, how it's impacted our nation and impacted us personally. So when go back to the original question of how did I feel about that? I felt a heavy weight lifted from my shoulders and that there was hope, you know, not to give up. And wow. So it's an amazing thing.
I mean, to me, just it didn't look like it was ever going to get overturned. And then this disruptor in chief, Donald Trump, gets elected president and says, hey, all bets are off. I don't see why we can't change things. And man, he went about doing it. And it was just an amazing thing. This is to his credit. First of all, We give thanks to God, but then Donald Trump showed up,
and he said,
"Hey, well, I'm going to be a bull in a china shop," and the china shop was not pleased with that. And I thank God we elected him, and it shows you what one man can do. We need to all pray for Donald Trump. They will not let up until he is destroyed. That is what they are hell bent on doing, because we, through Donald Trump, we totally upset their abortion apple cart, their liberal apple cart. Their agenda got so tremendously quashed as a result of this man's. And thank God, all the prayers. But my goodness, it took 50 years for us to see this thing dispatched the way it should have been. Well, that's a great thing. So tell us about your story. I mean, you were 19 when you had an abortion. Tell us about what happened. You were living in Pennsylvania at the time. The great Keystone State?
I was living in the great state of Pennsylvania, and that's where I was raised, lived there as a child. And then I became pregnant when I was 19. I was a freshman in college, and I was like most women would be. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to tell my parents because I was in college, wanted to complete school. I went to a Planned Parenthood facility, like I said before, and I was guided into having an abortion. I was not told that the development of my baby was a blob of tissue, a mass of cells, and I could get on with my life. So I actually flew down to Washington, D.C. This was January of 1973. It was around the time that Roe v. Wade was coming through the court. I can tell you that it was very painful what I went through, not only physically, but emotionally. And I changed that day. I went into a downward spiral of regret, depression, ended up quitting school, alcoholism, wow. Promiscuous relationship. I'd completely changed. And subsequently, because of the promiscuous relationships, I became pregnant again and I aborted again. And it took probably about 7 years of this downward spiral till I became suicidal. And I ended up leaving with my boyfriend, Pennsylvania, to come down to Louisiana, to New Orleans, of all places. And that's where I got saved. I turned my life to Jesus, crying out for help. And he heard my cry. And I found a lot of healing. And I've realized that I'm not the only woman. There's millions of us across the nation. So yeah. In the healing part, I have been working to help women not only learn the truth about abortion, but to offer them other options.
Great. So then, and now you work at a crisis pregnancy center in New Orleans, or whereabouts? Is it New Orleans?
It's outside of New Orleans, a little town called Slidell, which is on I-10, I-12, and I-59. So we're sort of like a portal to New Orleans, but we help women on the Gulf Coast, New Orleans area, our own community. I've been doing this for about 34, 35 years. So that's the healing part and the redemptive part of, I just do not just believe that abortion's wrong and it damages and hurts women, but we have to commit our lives to doing something about it and to helping women. So that's what we're doing.
Right. Well, let me ask you, you know, you in the span of gosh, 40 years, you know, you, I'm sure, talked to a lot of women who've had abortions. And have you seen many of the angry, what I call the angry ones? They used to be a sidewalk counselor. And the what we used to say was, well, this one guy I remember said, if they're black, they'll talk to you. If they're white, they'll abuse you. They'll lash out at you. And a lot of Hispanics would lie to you. They weren't comfortable with it. They want to face up to it. So you had this whole gamut of different, let's say, profiles in abortion. Have you seen a lot of people who are refer to as the angry feminists who support abortion vehemently? Have you seen them, any of them, turn around? Do you have any stories like that?
I do. You know, I will tell you that I see those women on the media. I see them, you know, being showcased, but I see the broken hearts in my office. And I like to even just reach out to those that are angry, you know, the feminist, and because I feel like they're hiding something. There's something there, whether maybe some are being paid to do that, others, they're justifying the pain that's in their heart and it's turned into anger, and they may have had an abortion in their past. But I have, Bill, I've debated feminists and debated those that are ardent pro-abortion. I've even invited a few to come over to our office and just to sit down and talk. Not all have come, but some have actually changed their hearts and their minds, because there's a deeper root of what's going on in their heart. There's an anger, a hardness there that, and a control, wanting to be a spirit of control that I can try, you know, to reach out with love.
Wow. So then, have What do you find when they talk? Do they open up about it and kind of warm up to revisiting their abortion? Or how does that play out when you have a conversation with these women?
Well, sometimes, you know, it's building relationship, and it might not even be the first time or the second time, but it's building, trying to build a relationship and, you know, showing that there is some compassion and care that's there. But when initially a woman who has stuffed down the pain of abortion and it comes out in anger or justification, she will not necessarily identify that all the pain in her life has been tracked back to that abortion. And there may also be some other things that may have occurred. Doesn't justify the reason why she aborted, but it could be sexual abuse as a child. She's been abandoned by a father. She has different underlying issues. And the abortion is actually just a manifestation of, you know, of even that pain. The very, very sad thing about that is that there's another human being that had to die, that died, you know, as a baby. So she's almost compounding that problem.
You're not grieving it. I mean, the thing is that when you don't grieve a loss, and there's, let's say, an implication of the person who should grieve in the death of that child, you have what they call, I guess clinicians call it, complicated grief. And then if you deny it's human, then you never go through the grieving process. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. And on top of that, we have a culture and even a government that says, and even clinicians that say, women don't grieve from abortion, that there's no such thing as post-abortion trauma. There's, you know, some classifications, but you know, there's a loss there, and that loss is another human life. And I go back to, even if we don't have all of the science that we know and the surveys that we know that women grieve, is that, you know, when I was younger, I gravitated towards the baby dolls and nurturing and loving. And abortion Wow. goes against the way that a woman was created, with this, most of us, a nurturing and wanting to take care of, not kill our children, but wanting to take care of our children. So there's, I'll take it even forward. There's, I believe, a conflict now, because for 50 years, abortion was approved by the government. It was seemed to be okay. And now we're revisiting that as a nation, saying publicly, abortion's not okay. And I believe, Bill, that there are women whose hearts are being conflicted now, and it's surfacing, that pain's surfacing, and it's time for healing.
Right. Do you see any connection between the abortion culture and where we've come concerning? I mean, we've seen a totally new development of what it means to be a woman. I'm not even talking about the transgender issue, but there's a new face of the young woman now, and it's not feminine. It's very hard, angry, masculinized to quite an extent. I don't know. Do you think there's a connection there between this whole thing with, you know, the movement towards, you know, same-sex relationships, you know, and of course that also the whole topic of the transgender thing, and the attack on womanhood and on femininity is so glaring. And then there's another attack on it through men who were into the transgender movement, and they want to, you know, pretend to be women, you know. Any thoughts? Have you seen a connection at all, or maybe I'm crazy?
No, I believe that that's a key point. That's very reflective, because there's something going on there. And that's where, as a woman, I'm standing up and saying, I am a woman. And cannot people see? Let's just take back in 1972, 1973, the rhetoric was, this is between a woman and a doctor, her doctor. This is, women have reproductive rights. There was all this rhetoric that was going on. Now we fast forward to 2022, And it's what is a woman and pregnant people, and that it's no longer between a woman and her doctor, because there's now been a push for chemical abortions, the abortion pill, where a woman doesn't even have to see a medical professional. She didn't have to see a doctor. So I agree with you there, that there is an attack on womanhood. And one of the reasons why I believe is because we have the ability to reproduce. We need men, but we're the ones that give birth, you know. And so I think women really need to understand that this time, in 1973, we were duped and we didn't speak up. But in 2022, I believe women need to realize this is an attack on womanhood. And we need to speak up.
All right. So did you, you must have seen, and your parents must have seen a big change in yourself after your abortions. Did they notice? Did they know about it at the time?
My parents did not know, but they did see a change in me. You know, by this time I had left college, and then I moved out of the house, lived about an hour away from where my hometown was, but they could see that there was a significant change in me. And I was able to hide some of that because I did live far away, but there was a point where my mom especially, she just said, if you need help, come back and see me. She stopped reaching out to me. So,
was she trying hard to?
Yes, she was. She was.
You didn't, I guess reaching back to your mother would have meant talking about your abortions, right?
Yes. And she did not know, but in her heart, I think she did know. But she never said anything to me. And, you know, that's what I want to encourage. You know, if there's any parent or anybody out there listening that has either abortion in their past or they've been affected by abortion, don't let it stew down there. Don't stuff it anymore. It's time to get to talk to somebody about that pain, because there's help.
Right, right. So then tell us about, you know, there was a role with Operation Outcry in the overturn of Roe v. Wade. Tell us about how that happened. It saw fruition, I guess, in the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health case. How did Operation Outcry participate in that? And tell us first briefly what Operation Outcry is and how it, what impact it might have had on the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health decision of the Supreme Court of the United States that overturned on June 24th of this year Roe v. Wade.
Well, what happened was many years ago, almost early 2000, Alan Parker, who's the president of the Justice Foundation, was directed really by the Lord to collect sworn affidavits of women who had been hurt by abortion. And since that time, there's been over 5,000 legal declarations or affidavits that have been collected of women like myself who have been hurt by abortion. Those declarations, you can actually still go ahead and sign one of those declarations through the website, operationoutcry.org. It was the intent that our voices be heard and for those to be used legally, that abortion was not good for women, that it hurt women. So the intent was then to go ahead and take it through state legislatures, and also to take those up to the Supreme Court. We were often, our testimonies were used as a friend of the court brief. Gonzalez versus Carhart, there were over 200 of the affidavits that were used when the court ruled against partial birth abortion. And one of the justices stated that it's significant that there are some women that suffer from abortion. So now with the Dobbs case, and also there was the case in Louisiana that was a few years ago, but in the Dobbs case, there were over 200 women that had second trimester abortions and significant impact of what they went through, both physically and emotionally, in the harm.
Oh my gosh.
of abortion. Yeah, second trimester abortion. And I mean, just, it's very hard to listen to some of the stories, but those stories being heard were significant impact on the court to be able to hear from the voices of the women or patients who had had abortions. And that type of impact is then what helped to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Great. Well, it's a great participation in towards healing among women who've been there and now want to expose it for what it is. So now, what's the connection with human trafficking? I know you've been worked a lot with that for the state of Louisiana, and you've been involved with it. You know, how did you get involved with that? What's your work? What's the connection with abortion and, you know, with the culture of death?
Yeah, it's interesting, Bill, because I do a lot of mission work, and I had gone over to India and did some work over there. And, you know, we always hear about that with sex trafficking and human trafficking. But I came back to Louisiana, my home state, and had opportunity to go do outreach in the clubs, the strip clubs downtown in the French Quarter.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's just because I had a heart to help women. And so when I went there, and I would go ahead and I'd go maybe once or twice a month with a team, and I started seeing women who were pregnant down there dancing. And then I realized that some of those were the women that I was serving back in our pregnancy center. And then I realized I think some of these women, they're being trafficked. And so around that time, I gathered information and I became aware of a colleague now. Her name's Dr. Laura Lederer, and she was doing a study on human trafficking and surveying over 200 survivors of trafficking. And she wasn't really looking for it, but what she found in her survey was that 70% of women who had been trafficked had become pregnant during trafficking, and 55% of those women who had become pregnant during trafficking had been forced to have one or more abortions. One woman, as many as 17 abortions during the time she was trafficked. And so, like in my heart, Laura, Dr. Lederer, she was doing the survey, and she does a tremendous outreach to women who have survived trafficking. But I was thinking of, nobody's reaching the women who have been prostituted or trafficked because they're being discounted, and also thinking that their babies are of no worth. And people don't realize that these are real human beings, both inside and outside the womb. And actually, like with me, I was thinking, even in the lineage of Jesus Christ is Rahab, who was considered a harlot, you know, a prostitute during the Battle of Jericho. And if the Lord has her name mentioned in the Bible, that means that that's significant to him, that both the woman and the baby be reached. So that at that time, I began partnering with Dr. Lederer in seeing how we could provide help to women who had been prostituted and throughout their pregnancy, whether they wanted to parent or whether they wanted to place their baby for adoption. And also that finding out that if that woman is provided with some help as a survivor of trafficking, often that baby gives her the courage to get out of that life.
And wow. Yeah. Amazing.
Part of the
wow. Goodness gracious. How does that ministry work? How do you reach out to with a team of people to women involved in these strip clubs? And wow, amazing. How's that go down?
Yeah. And you know, it's, I never thought at the age that, because this was from 2009 to 2016 of really doing a lot of the outreach. I never thought that I would be doing that, but I knew that my heart was, that's where the Lord was leading me. What happens is that, I'll just put it this way. There's a great network of pregnancy centers all throughout the United States. There's over 3,000. So simply the same things that pregnancy centers have been doing for years in reaching women in need during pregnancy, they just needed an extra skill set of being trained how to reach women who were pregnant and who had also been trafficked. So what I found as we, Dr. Lederer and I started to develop a training, is that there were other pregnancy centers like ours that were doing the same types of outreaches, because they too were finding women who had been prostituted in their community or trafficked, because every community has human trafficking. You know, research shows that. So we decided that we were going to go ahead and train the compassionate community of pregnancy centers how to reach women who had been trafficked, and partner with law enforcement, partner with government, partner with resources for healing, partner with immigration, you know, whatever it was. And so that's what we do. Now, on the other side of it is that we just did simple outreaches of compassion and caring down to the clubs. And
what do you, last question, Cynthia, Do you go inside the clubs? Do you stand outside the clubs? Do you have signs? What do you do?
What we
maybe
did
can't talk about it.
No.
Specifically.
What we did was we built relationship, and we built relationship with the bouncers. We built relationship with the people that worked inside. And initially we took things in like roses and candy. And, you know, I just acted like a person, a woman that cared, because I did. We knew what our limitations were. We didn't try to preach, push, or anything like that. We were just simply giving gifts. And then we also, provided the team that I worked with, we also provided health outreaches of dental care, medical care, you know, people that had addiction problems, trying to reach people where they were. Wow. And just let them know that there was a community that was there to help.
Oh my gosh. So, I mean, just curious, I mean, in New Orleans, how many strip clubs are there?
At the time, and this is before COVID, at the time we would go to maybe 10 to 12 of the clubs on Bourbon Street. And it doesn't mean that we were allowed to go into every club, but we tried to build relationship and let the employees, the staff there know that we were there for, really, it was for, you know, health needs and just to treat as humanity, you know, caring as humanity. And then, you know, on occasion, Bill, there were pimps, you know, there were traffickers that they could see that they, out of that relationship, they wanted out of it too.
And oh, wow. So in other words, they were bailing as well.
Yes. And I will just say that's the power of Jesus' love, and also the power of relationship, and just treating another person like they're a human being, you know. Yeah. And digging down deeper a little bit of how did you get there? How did you get to this point that this is where your life is? So, and that's where, like, my story of abortion in my past and what happened with me, I was able to have some understanding of where their heart was, but also offer them a way out.
Oh, man. That's a great work. And so you have a network of doctors, dentists, maybe social workers, counselors.
And we network with other organizations and ministries, because everybody has a different part that they play. There are some people that they're the rescuers. I mean, it's law enforcement, and it's crossing all different lines, that there might be ministries, organizations, government, you know, law enforcement and everything. But the goal is to bring restoration to that woman's life. And if she is pregnant, to help her along the way in that restoration, to either choose to parent that baby or to place the baby for adoption, for both of them to get help.
So you must see also hostile reactions to your ministry as well. I mean, like, you know, traffickers who don't want you anywhere near those clubs because you're bad for business, right?
Well, and that's true. And that's where there's great caution that needs to be taken. And because it's very evil. It's very, very evil. And, you know, people, it's sort of like a hot button issue, and you know, sometimes it may look like glamorous for people that do that type, do this type of stuff, but there's great caution that needs to be taken because it's very, very evil. But when there's somebody that's asking for help, and also, she has to make a decision whether she's going to come out of that life, and it can mean her own life when she chooses to not have an abortion, not be forced to have an abortion, because if she has the baby, then that means that she'll be taken off the street or whatever for a period of time. So there's a lot to it.
Well, yeah, there's a huge problem associated, at least talked about, with human trafficking, the Super Bowls, and of course, you know, you have the Superdome in New Orleans. And, you know, the New Orleans, unfortunately, has become a magnet for a lot of people out to party like crazy and do whatever they feel like doing. So it's a very, it lends itself to be, to a lot of evil industries, you know. So do you have any stories about women who've turned their lives around and have left that you can share?
We do. There's a few of them, of women that have found us and other organizations that we work with. And one woman that was actually in an abortion facility in another city, and because Louisiana has a law that the abortion facilities had to have a poster in there about human trafficking and that there was help available. And even they had to refer them, let them know that there were pregnancy centers that could help. This woman found her way to us. And then we partnered with another center. She was able to go ahead, and there was housing, counseling, immigration got involved, a lot of help. And her baby actually gave her, again, the courage to go ahead and really press through the healing and to move out of prostitution, forced prostitution, and then change, you know, get her life changed around. And so, and those stories are pretty much the same when the woman makes the decision to go ahead and have her baby. We also had a young woman that came to our facility, and she was brought here by her trafficker. And she didn't leave the first time, but the second time she found her way here, we were able to help her get back to her family. And she ended
up in the country?
No, it was in the United States. And she was she was from the U.S., but we were able to help her get back to her family.
You know, what percentage would you think, would you estimate, Cynthia, are underage girls, under 18?
You know, Bill, that statistics show that, you know, the younger age group, which I don't have, you know, this statistical number on that, but, you know, trafficking can happen as young as even with babies. It's just very sick and very evil. But the younger the woman is, the more value that she has too. And then the longer she would be trafficked also. So it's very,
well, how evil.
Yeah. And the things that are going on in our nation right now, it's just very concerning to me of things regarding our border, the young children that are coming in, and, you know, I just have this sensing in my heart of the evil that's going on. And there are things that we can do. Number one, pray. And then also, if we see something, that we go ahead and we report it. We just don't casually go by that we report it.
Right. And so, you know, have you gotten the impression, has it emerged that, you know, when you look at this situation, that a lot of the women being trafficked are immigrants? Is that getting to be a dominant pattern?
You know, I'm not sure because, we know, as I said, trafficking occurs in every community, but we know that there's a great influx of immigrants or people from other nations that are coming in here. And And it's of great concern because of the way that they're being brought across the border. There's, you know, young children that are being brought across the border. And I believe that their, you know, trafficking is a major part of it.
Right, sure. I mean, I've heard talk about how they are basically moved from Mexico, possibly, you know, originating from other countries, not just Mexico, but Central American countries, African countries, Asian countries, lots of places, South America. And they're given an armband and they don't have the money. They're basically committed to human trafficking and all that involved, whether it be selling drugs or selling their bodies in the United States. And they're charged, it's $8,000. And then they're brought to America to turn tricks or to sell drugs. And so that's what we see happening, a terrible thing. Well, you know, so people can find out more by going to Operation Outcry, right? www.operationoutcry.org. And you can also go to speakhope.net. Is speakhope.net your ministry that deals a lot with the trafficking issue or what?
It does with trafficking, but also with sexual abuse, healing from abortion. And it's really taking that person where they are in that, in those maybe specific areas, and bringing healing and restoration on in their life. So we also, Bill, try to reach the areas that are not being reached, as far as, you know, there's a lot of organizations maybe doing the same thing, and we try and reach the people and the people groups that are not being reached.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, this is fantastic. So I hope, hopefully people want to help. They can go to operationoutcry.org. They become monthly donors there, and they can become monthly donors to your organization.
They can do that. And they can also, if they need help, we have, with Speak Hope, we have two journals. One's called the Radiant Hope Journal, and the other one is called Redemptive Beauty Journal. And those two journals are to help with the healing process. They're not lengthy, but they've produced a lot of healing in the people that we work with. So, but operationoutcry.org or speakhope.net. So we're here to help.
Great. Fantastic. Well, Cynthia Collins, thanks a million for being on the Bill McIntosh Show. Much obliged. Godspeed to you. And may get a lot of people that learn about what you're doing and decide to participate and help directly or indirectly with this incredible ministry that you're doing to help help women that are really being victimized by this terrible scourge of human trafficking and abortion.
Right. And I am just thankful to be on with you, Bill. And I just want to say, he has a great call on women and on men. And, you know, all of our voices, all of us are needed. So thanks, Bill.
All right. Good. All hands on deck. Thank you, Cynthia. Godspeed to you and your ministries. And now, folks, we're going to have something really good. This is a rare James Buster Douglas interview that that I had with Buster Douglas, talking about fighting Mike Tyson and the preparation beforehand. Remember, this is an incredible case of a man who just lost his mother. Mike Tyson was 37-0. Buster Douglas was looked upon as just one more speed bump in Mike Tyson's career. He was a contender for sure, but nobody gave much of a chance. There were 42-1 odds when they were even bothering to take odds in Vegas against Buster Douglas. So it's an amazing story, and it's one of my greatest little interviews. So enjoy it, folks, and look forward to having you on again, the Bill McIntosh Show.
We take you up to fight day. You were up, you were about, oh, was it 235 or a little bit less?
231.
Okay. So were you happy with that weight?
Yeah, I was very happy with it, because the 40 and under was good for me, but in the 30s and then 20s, it was even better. It was like, you know, I felt that I could go forever, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I was so strong.
Right.
And go forever. I was in great shape. I was playing in great shape.
So now we're on the fight day. Tyson had been monkeying around with girls. Greg Page, whom you beat, knocked him down. Did you know about that? He was sparring with Greg Page. Did you hear about that?
I didn't know about what was he doing over there.
Yeah.
He wasn't doing any other fighting, so it wasn't no fucking excuse about fucking around with girls. He did every fight.
Yeah.
He's an animal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So,
it was bullshit. He ready to go, because if he wasn't ready to go, he'd have went in one or two, because what I was putting on him in the 10th round, 8th round, 7th round, 6th round was the same thing I put on him in the first round.
James, do you know what... James, you know, do you remember the stats on you versus Tyson as far as the number of punches landed?
No.
It was, okay, you threw approximately 441 punches, 230 of them connected. Tyson threw 214 punches and 101 connected. And when you look at those tapes of those fights, every round you're jabbing him on command, at your own will, on your own pleasure. You were just hitting him steadily, left and right, with jabs. And what stuns people... What stuns people is here's Tyson, 37-0 when he goes into Tokyo Dome on the 11th of February when you beat him. Tyson is only hit you half as many times as you did. You hit him. And it was a steady barrage. And the judges, the Japanese judges, had him ahead of you or even. What do you think of that, huh?
Well, that was amazing. But that's what my dad always said, only short decision is a knockout. You know, because they can dispute it any way they can, and then once Buffalo is standing there in the fight, well, Devin put up a great effort, but, well, he just came up a little bit short, and it's like, well, that would have been horrible.
Oh, yeah.
It horrible to that.
Went to the judge's decision, sure. So you had an unlucky moment in round 8. You got an uppercut from Tyson. You went down. Was there something that your dad told you that you didn't do, that you forgot to remember, you forgot to do when that happened?
Yeah, I stood in front of him. I stood in front of him and started admiring my work. I was looking at him like, yeah, what do you think about me now, motherfucker?
Because he thought he disrespected you. I mean, let me ask you something. What happened at the weigh-in? That's something I've never seen a film of that. I've never seen a tape of the weigh-in. Was he like disrespecting you in Tokyo?
I don't recall that, you know, at the weigh-in. But he was being nonchalant about everything, you know, for sure. You know, but I didn't care less. So I was like, well, whatever. Because I didn't think that he thought anything anyway. That's why we were in Tokyo. So I knew about that from the fight was going.
So you were feeling proud, and you were sick of the guy. I mean, you just thought you saw him, you know, talk trash to a lot of people, I guess. So then you come back after the end of the 8th round, and people thought you were gonna collapse in round 9. Tell us about round 9 and round 10.
Well, like I was felt good after the knockdown. I wasn't too shaken up. And by the end of the beginning of the ninth round, I felt really strong and ready to go back out there and get back in charge, get back in control of the fight.
Sure.
That's what I did to get back.
Tell us about the 20 seconds prior to the 5-round combination when you sent him to the canvas and history was made.
Well, I was just... you know, having backing up on his heels, and JD yelled out, you know, pivot. And I pivoted, and when I pivoted, I seen the uppercut. You know, and I caught him with that uppercut, and I nailed him because I had everything in it.
Yep.
And then I finished with the next four punches, so it was a 5-punch combination, starting off with that uppercut. And just, you know, get to do. But I still thought when I went back to the corner that he was going to get up because he kept getting up and taking those shots throughout the fight. But once I seen him reaching for that mouthpiece, I knew it was over then.
You win the fight. you know, I don't want to talk about King, Don King questioning it and trying to take it away from you, but tell us about your corner. Tell us about the Jubilation.
Yeah, they were excited. The best part about the whole thing was when they announced me as the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. Hearing that was just like, wow, that's it, I did it.
Did you feel like maybe like this is a dream, and you know I'm about to wake up and I got to go to the Tokyo Dome and fight Tyson? It's not real.
Not at all. Not at all. I felt very focused, and I knew where I was at the whole time. It was just once they announced the champion, that did it. But what really did it is when I got that belt. But then it took them to come and find out, you know, they didn't even bring another set of belts.
Well,
that belt that I got received in the ring was Mike Tyson. One of my guys seen that belt laying on the table and picked it up and gave it, handed it to me.
Wow. Wow, what a moment. I mean, and so your grandfather's there. Your brother, yes. Bill, is there too? Was he there too?
Hello?
One of your brothers was there in Tokyo with you?
Yeah, my brother Robert.
Right.
Yeah,
so
he was a short guy. He came over to me too. He was on camera too. He was him, and then my son Lamar, my oldest son Lamar, was there. He was like 12.
Oh my God. And so what time was it in Columbus when you beat Tyson?
In Columbus, it was probably 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, or at night. And in Tokyo, it was at noon.
Right. So did you call your dad? Tell us about that.
Yeah, the conversation was like, "Son, I'm so proud of you. You did it. You did it. You did it. You fought a great fight.
Wow.
That was beautiful. Beautiful. I love it.
And you know, you come back. What was? Tell us about what's going down in Columbus, Ohio when you returned.
Came back, we first landed in Chicago. And then we were walking down the jetway, and I was talking to a friend of mine who was walking and talking, and I looked up and I said, I don't know what's going on down there, because I know there's a lot of commotion at the end of the jetway. And I had no idea that they were down there for me, and I was like, I wonder what's going on down there. it still hadn't really, it hadn't hit.
You're still a regular guy, man. You're still a regular guy. It didn't hit you yet.
Right, it was like, what's the commotion? What's going on? You know, lights and...